Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, bringing you 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We're live now, and then you can catch us later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates you need, fast and focused. It's Friday, the 23rd of August, coming up on the program, South Africa's artificial intelligence policy framework and its impact on small business. Why we have a school's reading crisis, particularly when it comes to teachers themselves. Man versus baboon. The big fight continues in Cape Town. And the diminishing number of women in South Africa's labor market. Why is this happening? South Africa's national AI policy framework, in place to harness potential to drive economic growth and societal well-being, aims to integrate AI to enhance productivity, stimulate innovation, and position this country as a leader in AI development. That's an excerpt from an article by Lindsay Shooters, who is editor for ICT, Construction and Engineering, as well as Energy and Mining at Biz Community. And he joins me on the program now. And Lindsay, first up then, how effective has this framework been in positioning the country as a leader in this place?
Wonderfully, South Africa has leaned into its biggest strength, which is like a human-first, human-centric approach to technology and rolling it out to help address some of the issues that we have in society. So this one, like, our government is taking the view that it's a transformative force with the potential to significantly impact the economy. First, but we have to do it responsibly.
What do we mean by a human-centric approach?
So using it in the most inclusive way possible. So there's a strong emphasis on the ethical AI development, and so that it can include as many people as possible and improve their situations in more general ways, and then build from there to sophisticated to like more elite kind of use cases.
Responsible,
so a bottom-up approach, yeah.
Responsible use, I would suggest to you, is one thing, but also critical that government ensures through this framework that AI technology is accessible, particularly to those in underserved communities. I would also suggest that we're a long way off the mark as far as that's concerned.
So what I do like about the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies in its current form is that they came straight out the gates, Salim Alatsi came straight out the gates, engaging with device manufacturers to try and just bring the cost to entry down for the majority of South Africans. So there's a lot of talks happening behind the scenes to try and just bring the cost of smartphones down, and then also smartphones capable enough that we can then deploy more digital and AI-backed technologies.
In your opinion, does this policy framework support entrepreneurship in technology-driven sectors, or again, is there deficiency there?
There's a big deficiency because the cost of building AI solutions in South Africa is insane. Just the cost to access the hardware, to access the servers, there's a big problem there. So what we're getting in South Africa at the moment is kind of secondhand AI, where the big platforms are developing the engines, and then we are given the opportunities to kind of build solutions with those engines. So for me, that's the biggest problem that we still need to solve, where we can start building our own services from scratch. And we have the capabilities in our universities to do this.
So if, as you suggest, when it comes to AI, we're driving an old VW Jetta, how do we start aspiring then to a BMW, for instance? Is it simply a money play, or is there more to it than that?
I think there's more partnerships that need to start happening, and they are. Like, I had a good conversation with Google Africa. They flew out their global kind of consumer AI person to South Africa, and I had a nice conversation with her. They are the partnerships that are happening. There are grants that are coming South Africa's way from the likes of Amazon Web Services, from Google, from Microsoft even, where researchers are allowed like a certain amount number of credits to use these services and start building it. But we're a long way away from actually being in a position of strength and being able to afford that capacity. So we kind of have to do it on other people's terms right now.
One of the big fears, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, is the potential of job displacement when it comes to artificial intelligence. And particularly, I think that's more stark in a developing economy like South Africa's. Are there measures in place, or should there be measures in place to deal with this particular threat? Or, as some are suggesting, perhaps more robustly, we've just got to learn to live with it because it's inevitable that people will be out of work as a result of this.
So I had a lovely conversation with CCI, which is one of the big like call center agencies in South Africa. They pretty much bolt um schlanger. And they were telling me that while there is a big risk for AI to disrupt the BPO industry, the call center industry, there will always be a need for inbound calling for that human touch and that human, and it's all about they professionalizing the call center agency, where there are career paths now that you can go through, and they investing more in AI being able to help the agent do their work more efficiently, and then turbocharge their career prospects as well.
Lindsay, let me ask you this. When you have a framework like this, is this simply something which acts as almost an organic guide because we know that this particular discipline is changing all the time? Or is this something that also needs to be used in time more robustly as a regulatory mechanism?
So this is the foundation that we can start from to then build out the AI regulations and then potentially in the future an AI Act. And yeah, I enjoy the way that the government is going through this. They engaging all stakeholders. And yeah, I think it's an important document to have. And we have criticized the Ramaphosa administrations for being a bit more lead by committee. But the long-term effects of that is we have more robust foundations to work from. So I think there's an important part of that.
I'm going to leave it there. Lindsay Shooters, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, the training of primary school teachers needs urgent reform if every South African child is to read fluently by the age of 10, according to a new assessment from the 2030 Reading Panel. This panel, chaired by former Deputy President Phumzile Mlambo-Ngcuka, was established in 2022 to advise the government on how to improve children's poor reading skills, which at present, and I don't need to tell you, is a major obstacle to their success at school. She joins me on the program now. And first of all, welcome, thank you, and what are the main problems?
Well, my principal concern, obviously, is that children are reaching grade 4 without the capacity to read and comprehend. And we do not have teachers that are adequately trained to teach early grade literacy. And if you think of foundation phase teachers, the most important thing for a foundation phase teacher is to know how to teach a child to read, write, and count. If a teacher comes out of the university without the skill to teach that, you know, it's game over. So we've now gone back to university to ask universities to look at their curriculum and to address this issue. But fortunately, they are also concerned about this issue. They've had to do an introspection and to really look at how they can change the way a teacher who gets a B.Ed at foundation level is trained. So last week we had a conference and it was good to receive a report from different universities about the initiatives they've taken.
What specific reforms do you think are needed in university curricula to ensure that primary school teachers are better prepared then?
You know, for instance, right now, in a B.Ed degree for foundation level, only about 5% of the time is devoted to teaching teachers on how they can teach literacy. This suggests that when the teachers graduate and get into a school, they have some theory about literacy, but they have no practical skills. Even when they do practice teaching while they are still at university, they are not tested on this. So the reform that is required first is to increase the amount of time that is spent training them, and they have to be tested before they graduate, so that by the time you unleash the teachers to the children, you know that this is a good product. Right now, you know, schools don't know what they will get. And also we have to increase the number of teachers who are trained to teach mother tongue. That is another crisis. Mm. Right now, a high number of teachers don't know how to teach mother tongue. Even more complicated, you can be Zulu speaking, go to a university that maybe teaches Sesotho as a language, doesn't teach you Zulu, and then you end up teaching in a school where the children speak Sepedi. You can imagine. So all of that has to be arranged very carefully because of the complexity of the language terrain in our country.
Let me suggest to you that it is partly a skills and learning issue, but I wonder if you also think that the wrong people are entering the teaching profession and are being accepted too easily by the universities without reasonable due diligence and pre-testing.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Most of the people who train to become teachers, especially in these those who will be teaching languages, they go to this particular degree because they cannot get into the other degrees. So it's not their best choice. It's just so that they can have a degree. They don't love teaching. So we have a difficult situation, and this is not only in South Africa, by the way. In many countries, there is that problem that the people who end up as teachers are not the people for whom teaching is a calling, but also they are not intellectually aligned with what is expected of them.
So critical to that point is that how do you change the public perception of teaching as a profession to attract more academically proficient students into education facilities?
I guess we just said that they're not being trained well at university, but it means that even before they get to university to be trained as teachers, we have to start encouraging, shaping, and focusing on making sure that you will have high school graduates who will go to university with the right skills, the right aptitude, etc., so that they will take on education as a profession and they will be committed to do what is needed.
Do you think that government is playing a sufficient supporting role to universities to improve the quality of teacher training programs?
They can do much more, especially now, because a high number of teachers are going to be leaving the system. In 2030, we expect, and this is just attrition because of age and other reasons, there was just going to be a physical shortage of teachers. So government has to see that there is an increased number of people who train for education and who stays as teachers, because the other thing is that they train, they start to teach, and they leave. Most of the teachers who are trained to be teachers do not end up as teachers. So that's another challenge. And we need also to have a continuous training for teachers who are already in the field. So we have to fix pre-teaching, in other words, while they are still at university, and we have to continue to train them while they are already teaching.
I am going to leave it there with my thanks. Phumzile Mlambo-Ngcuka, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The labour force participation rate for women in South Africa is 54.3% compared to 65% for men. Over the past decade, the female participation rate has increased by 4 percentage points, some improvement, but barriers still remain. Now, recent SA Tide research highlights that despite more women entering the labour force, the wage gap has widened. Women earn significantly less than men. Addressing these disparities can enhance women's empowerment and economic welfare. And I'm joined now by Ayanda Hlatswayo from the National Treasury and also SA Tide. And first of all, why is the participation rate still significantly lower?
You know, I'm not sure that we should be surprised. I think it's important to note that gender gaps in labor force participation persist globally. So likewise, in South Africa, fewer women have been participating in the labor force in or the labor market compared to men, and we're yet to close the gap. A lot of strides have been made, but, you know, as you indicated, with the latest QLFS in the second quarter of 2024, the labor force participation rate for women was at 55.8%. And at 65.6% for men. So the main reason, you know, for this is that women continue to take on household-related duties. A higher share of women in South Africa spend more time on childcare, household chores, being caregivers, and other restrictive responsibilities that limit their opportunities to participate in the labor market. So providing support to women to reduce some of these responsibilities is important. And some of the policy options that I think can be used to assist with this is providing childcare services, targeting women through social protection and public works programs, as well as increasing access to finance for women. I think we can't emphasize enough the importance of finding ways to increase labor force participation for women and to reduce the gender wage gap, especially in South Africa, where a lot of households are female-headed households. There's literature that indicates that increasing financial independence and property ownership for women, women tend to invest more in the household than men by investing in health and educating children, which has positive intergenerational effects.
Specifically, where is there a deficiency in support and how can it be accelerated?
You know, I think we have to sort of look into some of the reasons behind the widening wage gap, right? So some of the reasons underlying that are, you know, occupational segregation and institutional barriers that act as disincentives for women to advance in their careers. For example, women may experience a motherhood penalty where women face career interruptions due to child rearing. I just want to quickly highlight a study that we've produced through the SA Tide program. We're using the tax data that we house in the National Treasury's Secure Data Facility. And maybe just to highlight quickly that the SA Tide program is just a collaboration between UNUWIDA, National Treasury and SARS, where we've made tax administrative data available for research. And essentially, Michelle Pleason and some of her co-authors produced a working paper that estimated the persistent gender wage gap in South Africa's formal economy using administrative tax data between 2008 and 2021. And they found that in 2008, women earned 89 cents for every rand earned by men. And by 2021, this had dropped to 78 cents, which shows that there's an increasing wage gap over time. Now, the wage gap is most pronounced in the bottom 10% of income earners, where women earn significantly less than men. However, even with the top 10% earners, women earn about 85 cents to every rand that's earned by men or by men. So this study shows that the occupational choices contribute more to the wage gap at the bottom of the distribution, where women are likely to occupy lower paid positions within industries, particularly high skill sectors. So an example of this is in 2021, women made up About 78% of the workforce in the human health activities sector, but men occupied the more senior, high-paid positions. I think, you know, maybe to expand on that, you know, an example would be having more females who are represented amongst nurses, let's say, as opposed to more men being represented in the pool of doctors that would be in that sector. At the top end, you know, of the wage distribution, you find that women only account for a third of the higher paying management positions, and women managers earn less than their male counterparts in certain instances. And this has likely contributed to the persistent gender wage gap. So encouraging firms to provide equal pay for employees with identical roles and responsibilities is a crucial step towards equality, but also ensuring that we upskill women so that they can take up more high-skill positions, even in high-skill sectors.
But Ayande, you and I both know that just encouraging firms to try and close that gap or offer more opportunity is simply not going to happen. Is there a more robust solution to this? Does it maybe lie in some form of change legislation?
You know, I think enforcement of certain legislation that already exists should definitely be explored. But I also think more than just looking at the current policies that exist, which haven't, you know, fully been effective given the slow progress, although I must say that, you know, we need to note that there has been progress, although this is overshadowed by the statistics, you know, that we find where women are still experience higher unemployment rates irrespective of their educational background, for example. You definitely need, beyond the policies, I think it's to refine policies and have amendments and almost be able to make recommendations that are driven by evidence. So I think from my perspective, and I guess I always have a data bias where, you know, we need better data and research to inform policymaking. Globally, administrative data has been increasingly being used to drive decision making and research. National Treasury has recognized the value of this, and that's why we're making data available, and we're making that the forefront of collaboration between researchers and policymakers, and, you know, trying to create new types of studies and analysis with the big data that we've made available. So touching on, you know, studies like the one that I've just flagged to you today, I think is important. It's difficult to craft policies that can affect appropriate change if you don't have the right data to inform you about the problem that you have at hand. So what the administrative data has done is it has essentially closed a gap that was there previously, where we can now have a better understanding of the income distribution in South Africa, especially the high end of the distribution, which was not adequately captured previously by self-reported surveys. Mm. But that's not to say that this data isn't without its own challenges. You know, survey data is able to cover the informal sector, which the tax data can't. And I guess that's one of my responsibilities in my role as the acting chief data analytics officer at Treasury, but also as an SA Tide policy lead for the evidence-based data workstream. It's to identify new administrative data sources to conduct data-driven research and close gaps where possible by leveraging and improving and integrating the information that we collect through our administrative processes.
All right. Ayande Hlatswayo, thank you very much indeed from National Treasury. And I hope this conversation does find some resonance within organizations itself. Thank you so much for talking to me.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally on the program, in the idyllic Western Cape seaside town of Komaki, a war continues to rage between baboons and residents. And household raids seem to be increasing, and it's no laughing matter. There are concerns about safety. Megan Taplin is Table Mountain National Park Manager and joins me now. And Megan, first of all, what factors then have contributed to the recent increase in these raids?
I don't think this is a new issue. The situation with baboons and humans having some areas of conflict in Cape Town is not a new one. And the reason this is occurring is because We have a national park in the middle of an urban area, or in fact, an urban area surrounded by a national park with the terrestrial on the one side and the marine protected area on the other side. So you will have species that are moving in and out. There are also, you know, other natural areas on the peninsula that are not necessarily part of the national park, but for example, the green belts and areas like that. And what has caused this problem is that baboons have come to realize that they can get very high energy food in urban areas. And, you know, once they realize they can get access to that food, whether it's people's food inside their houses or it's waste that is not being managed properly, or it might even be fruit trees or vegetable gardens or dog food that's left outside. If they realize they can get that easily and it gives them a lot of energy, it's much more beneficial for them to do that instead of foraging in the natural fynbos area, which is a low nutrient system and where they can get food, but it's a lot more work to do so. And access to that high energy food has allowed their populations to expand. You know, it's easier to have babies and expand more quickly than if they'd only been using natural food. And this means that there are quite a lot of baboons now on the peninsula, or their populations have expanded, whereas the natural area available to them hasn't expanded.
Yeah, I was just going to say, on the flip side, the population of human beings is also increasing, isn't it?
Exactly. So if you look at baboons' natural habits are to roost in high-lying areas, whether it be mountains or trees, and then to forage in low-lying areas. And if you actually look at the low-lying areas, you know, how much they've been taken up by residential and urban development, there's not that much area left for baboons to forage in. The biggest area is actually that Cape Point area inside the park, which is the biggest low-lying area where they can forage, and there are a lot of baboons there already. But some baboon troops have actually started spending most of their time in the urban area, for example, in Komaki, where they've got there's a damaged building that was burnt down a few years ago that they're using to roost in. And then also in Simonstown, where there's a troop that's staying inside the Navy dockyards, and they're being attracted there by waste that's not being managed. So when that happens, then the baboons are spending most of their time in the urban area. And I think people are used to the baboons coming into, if we're talking specifically about Komaki now, they are used to baboons coming into that area, and there are baboon rangers or baboon monitors that are appointed by the city of Cape Town to move these baboons along. But when there's access to human food and human waste, it is difficult for them to be able to move baboons along. And so, what makes it more difficult is that some, you know, there's a polarization in some of these communities. For example, in Komaki, and another one is Scarborough, where some of the residents are really fed up with baboons and are fed up with the damage being caused and want the baboons out, while others really like having baboons around and think they're part of the ecosystem and part of why they want to live in an area like that, where they're close to wild areas and want to protect the baboons. So there are different opinions about whether baboons should be there or not and how they should be managed.
Different opinions, but are there different or new approaches that can be taken to mitigate the conflict between the baboons and the residents?
Yes, we have the joint task team, which has been set up between the three authorities, the local, provincial and national authority. So that's City of Cape Town, Cape Nature and then SANParks, because this is a complex situation and we all need to play our part to be able to manage it. And this joint task team has developed a strategic management plan, which needs to be rolled out. And that strategic management plan really sets out the objective, which is to try and keep baboons in the natural areas as much as possible and still have a wild baboon population on the Cape Peninsula, but also to use a variety of tools, and most of them need to be used together. No, there's no one single solution. So, for example, you know, waste management is an important tool. Strategic fencing is another tool. Education and awareness is a very important tool as well. And then, of course, there's also population control that needs to be thought about as well, whether it be moving baboons away or whether it be resorting to more drastic measures like euthanasia, that is something that needs to be thought about.
Megan Taplin, I'm going to leave it there. Regrettably, we are out of time, but I think we get the full picture. Manager, Table Mountain National Park, I do appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.